Welcome to The Treasure Hunt, my personal attempt to share my musical curiosity with you. My name is Bas Wiegers, and I'm a conductor. This time, I'm in my hometown, Amsterdam, preparing two concerts with the Concertgebouw Orchestra. Apart from amazing music by Maurice Ravel and Leo Smit, we will be performing two works by Theo Louwendy, his massive orchestral work Flexio, and a reworking of one of his most popular works, the Six Turkish Folk Poems. I'm very happy we managed to program these pieces, as Theo and I go back a long time. As a violin student, I played Dance, his solo for violin, and later, with the Insomnio Ensemble, his wonderful piece Venus and Adonis. I also played his violin concerto, Vanishing Dances, as a soloist for his 70th birthday concert at the Amsterdam Concertgebouw. This is now 23 years ago. Today, I'm visiting Theo in his home just behind the Concertgebouw. We speak briefly about his youth and his first musical encounters and influences, and then about the two pieces I'm preparing. Hello, Theo.
Hello.
It's really weird. We are going to switch to English. And it's weird because we know each other for, I don't know, 25 years, maybe?
Yeah.
And we've never spoken anything else but Dutch. But here we are with Theo Louwendy, wonderful composer. And I have the pleasure of conducting two of your pieces next week, Flexio and the Six Turkish Folk Poems. Before we go into those pieces, tell us a tiny bit about you were a clarinetist. You were started actually as a jazz musician. Then you got interested in Turkish music. Tell us a little bit, like concise, this your beginning of your life story.
Yeah, well, I grew up here in a neighborhood where nothing existed, nothing musical existed else than musicians that played in the streets, you know, and barrel organ. And because at home there was no instrument at all, and I had no father, only a mother, and she didn't know anything about music, so it was rather difficult. And
when you say here, you mean Amsterdam?
In Amsterdam,
actually,
yes.
not so far from where you are now.
No, not so far, but completely different in structure or social structure, completely different from the Concertgebouw neighborhood. Because most people were poor there, over there. And so the same goes for us at that time. And yeah, that was pretty difficult. My mother asked me when I was at my eighth birthday what I wanted to have. And I said a piano, because I knew already that composers, because at school I started to compose, you know, well, and under influence of a teacher, and he teaches me that Johann Sebastian Bach is the greatest composer of all time. And I asked my mother who was Johann Sebastian Bach, but she didn't know at all. And so it pictures the situation at that time. And so a year later, for my 9th or 10th birthday, the same question was asked. And I said, piano, please. No, impossible. So then I said, okay, give me a recorder. And that time, recorder was not emancipated as it is now. So it was treated as a children's instrument. And I got, I think, a metal one, if I remember well. And I started to, because I wanted to compose in a more polyphonic way. But on a wind instrument, you can only produce one pitch at a time.
Yeah.
And so I started to sing and blow the recorder at the same time, what was actually avant-garde, avant la lettre.
Absolutely.
Because that was 10 or 50 years later, it was very fashionable, you know.
Yeah.
And but for me, it was the only way to produce some kind of polyphony. And okay, and so it was very unusual, of course, to have musical education at the time. And then the war started, the World War, Second World War, and during those years there was no music at all.
Mm.
Even radio was forbidden here. So just after the end of the war, I heard jazz, so I was familiar with Bach, but then completely different influence because of the Allied forces in Europe. I started to listen to on the radio, for example, to bands that play jazz.
Yeah, amazing.
And first it was a little bit in the commercial way, Glenn Miller. Discovered the real stuff. That what I mean is Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis, and Thelonious Monk, all those heroes in jazz. And so that was the real, the first strong, after Bach, you could say, the first strong influence that I had. And the first, the first start to do something myself in music.
Because by then you played the clarinet also.
Yeah. So I borrowed a clarinet from the Post Harmony and started to mainly to develop the technique of the clarinet myself in the beginning. Later on it was a different story. And so I was 15 when the war ended, and it was only 10 years later, but that's a long time, that I went to the conservatory. So that was my first official training in music. Mm-hmm. And in between, I started to lead groups of musicians, amateurs in the beginning, of course. And so I immediately started to compose also for those groups. So composing was a very practical thing, apart from this abstract Johann Sebastian Bach. But in practice, I had these friends of mine around me and I wrote music.
And the composition was always somehow connected also to improvisation. So part was composed and part was improvised.
Absolutely. So I was really I was used to have musicians around me that could improvise. And I improvised myself from the beginning on.
Let's jump a little bit, because, I mean, this we can dwell on that period for a long time, but let's jump a little bit to the Turkish influence, or the more sort of, if I may use the word, exotic influences in your work. Because at some point later, when you finished the conservatory, one of your good friends was Nedley Elstak, and you, the two of you, somehow went on an adventure trip to Turkey, because you were going to play in a bar there for a while.
Yeah.
And somehow this shaped also your musical heritage a lot. You became very inspired by that music.
Yeah, so I had already those two influences, the classical music, Bach especially, and jazz. Mm. And then the first job I had abroad was with Natalie Elstak, who was actually, his parents were from Suriname, Dutch colony. So we were a kind of, what is the word, trailing?
Twin.
Twins, we were twins, yes, in jazz. And he had a job in a gig, as we say, in Turkey. And then he wrote me, come here, you can have work here in Turkey. So I went to Turkey and we played there for a few months in Istanbul on the Bosphorus. And that was very interesting. But the Turkish traditions in music stayed a little bit far from me. It was on the radio that I heard that and started to be interested a little. But then on the trip back on the boat from Istanbul to Marseille, I met a Turkish girl who had already finished her studies in law at the university. And so the trip from Istanbul to Marseille in southern France that lasted 5 days. And during those 5 days, we talked and talked and talked, and I fell in love with her, you know. And so with the harbor of Marseille inside, I thought, oh God, I have now to say something important to her, otherwise he goes to Geneva and I go to Amsterdam. And so I said, do you want to marry me? And she started to laugh and she said that's impossible.
Long story short, that became your first wife.
Yeah.
You married her.
Exactly.
You managed to marry her. And since then, Turkey has been like a constant inspiration,
because of the marriage, of course. I started to be more interested in the culture, and so that was a big influence.
And you learned Turkish also?
Yeah. I can say that I speak very well Turkish.
Since we are speaking about Turkey and that influence now, let's go to these Turkish folk poems, because you wrote them, I think, in 1977.
Yeah.
Right? For a very small ensemble and one singer.
Yeah.
Let's first talk a little bit about maybe the poetry. How did you find these? They are very beautiful, small poems, almost like very...
Yeah.
Very tiny aphorisms, almost.
Of course, I was. I started to love Turkish folk music, and I had. I don't know why, how I got it, but I had a booklet with 3,000 poems, anonymous folk poems, in Turkish, and so I chose six from those 3,000, and. Originally, I thought about, of course, that was very usual. I thought about translating them. But then I felt so close to the culture, because these poems represent the pure Turkish culture from the countryside that is actually an Asiatic language. And this language in the countryside, it was less influenced by Arabic and Persian words that were entered into the language, that were mixed. Actually, it is in the 20s of the 19th century, of the 20th century, that Ataturk, who made a republic out of the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, he started to invest a language committee, and they started every year they threw out Persian and Arabic words, and somewhere in Asia they found equivalents in pure Turkish language. Oh. This is the language that I use in these poems.
Oh, very nice. And you chose the poems first, and then you started to use them for the music?
Of course.
Or how?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you chose quite contrasting poetry, actually. I mean, some are very very gracious, very
some are nice, humoristic.
Some are very funny.
Yeah.
And you chose six out of this big, big book.
Yes.
And then you started to have an idea of sound in your head.
I don't know exactly the order of things, but I remember that the English singer Doris Idoro asked me to write something for her. And so then I looked at it, I found these poems, and that was also something completely unexpected for an English singer, a Dutch composer, and then instead of a Dutch or English text, a Turkish text, you know. I never regret it, actually. It sounded like it was suicide, you know, because who understands Turkish?
Yeah.
At that time, nobody. At that time.
And then if we go to how the music sounds and how the voice sounds, how much of that is really influenced by also either Turkish folk music or other kinds of folk music?
Yeah, that's of course a very interesting question. You could say maybe I can explain it already by the fact that when it, for the first time in the 70s, it was on television, and I was called first by a Turkish man who said, this has nothing to do with Turkish music. And I said, well, that it is not my intention to imitate Turkish music. I am a European composer that is influenced by these texts and feels an affinity to Turkish music. But so maybe there is some influence of the music also, but so anyway, it is not my intention to imitate. And okay, so this was a rather unhappy conversation, and then I was called again by the concertmaster of the Frisch orchestra that existed at that time, so let's say Northern Dutch Symphony Orchestra, and he was of Turkish descendants, And he said, just the contrary, he said, well, this piece will be permanent. And I was, of course, happy to hear that. But, well, until now...
Absolutely, it's still there. And yeah. Next, I mean, the concert that we're giving is
an example.
A proof of that.
Yeah.
But you, when we were speaking earlier, you mentioned an Egyptian singer whose kind of singing influenced more or less how you think about the voice. Did that help in writing it, or is that just an example for us to know how we should perform it?
Well, this Umm Kulthum, this Egyptian singer, is only an example of how, in general, in the Middle East, singing is... Europeans very often think that they sing with a lot of... The people in the Middle East sing with a lot of vibrato. But that is not the case at all. It is just the contrary. They sing without vibrato, but every note, straight as it is, has ornaments, almost every note.
Yeah.
This kind of thing. And that has influenced me, because in the folk poems you can hear that also.
If you would speak to somebody who sings a lot of Baroque music,
yeah,
or who plays a lot of Baroque music for that matter, they would always talk about vibrato in terms of embellishment, of ornamentation.
Exactly.
So I think it's not so far away.
No.
It's just that the romantic use of the voice or
exactly.
of the instruments has become a little bit different.
Yes.
Of
absolutely.
Course, now this piece goes from a 7 ensemble piece with one singer to an orchestra again. So you've actually changed quite a lot.
Yeah.
When we look at the how is this process going? Because this piece is 40 years old almost. No, it's 40
years
old.
Almost half a century. Yeah.
Almost 50. And now we asked you to make it into something else. How did that work for you?
The first when I was asked to do so by the Concertgebouw Orchestra, I had to think about it, because it's so the original chamber music version is so far removed from what you imagine orchestral, 19th century orchestral music. But after a few days, I answered that I will accept it. It has a consequence, because the distance of one practice and the other is so great that it was unavoidable for me to here and there to change the music a little bit. Because for example, to give an example, a crescendo for 7 instruments can last a few seconds and then that's it. But for orchestra to have the same effect emotionally also, you would need more time. So that is what I did. At some places I made the music a little bit longer, some passages, not everywhere of course, so almost half a century. After composing it, I was, of course, very eager to know if I had still the same ideas. And the surprising thing was that it felt like I composed a piece last week, you know.
Mm.
It's very close, actually. But in spite of course, a huge development that had taken place in my composing.
I think it's a very fresh, it's still a very fresh piece. It's a very inventive and very multifaceted. It has a lot of different energies, I think. Shall we go to Flexio?
Yeah.
Because this is a very different piece. It's 2 years later, end of the 70s, you wrote it, 79? Yeah,
so I discovered recently, I was amazed about it, that there is not so much distance in years between the two pieces.
No.
It was near the end of the 70s.
Yeah, because the Turkish folk poems are in 77.
Yeah.
And then in 78 you wrote Venus and Adonis, by the way, which is Venus and Adonis.
Oh, yeah,
In the year between. And then the year after you wrote Flexio. It was quite a productive couple of years. And Flexio is a huge orchestra piece.
Yes.
It's very big. We spoke already about it in private, but maybe you can tell a little bit what the title comes from. Why is it called Flexio?
Oh, yeah.
It's a bit technical, but maybe it's nice to understand.
To know. you know, Flexio means actually, you could say, the word flexible, for example, shows it. Something that can be... that's flexible, of course. Mm-hmm. And Flexio is the amplitude of how you can change something but keeping the same idea, but change the proportions. And that is what I did technically. So what I did was I, thinking about other composers, for example, I can give a very famous example of that. Nobody would say that when you hear pom 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 pom, pom 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 pom. Oh, that is surprising. The second third is a small third, and the first one is,
the first one is a major third, and the second one is a minor.
A major third and a minor third.
Yeah,
it has to do, of course, with the scale. So it feels like two same intervals.
Yeah.
To
the same. But this is the kind of flexibility.
And you see that everywhere with Bach, for example, you know, melodic line that is repeated and repeated, but changing with the harmony and so on. And I thought that maybe you can maintain the characteristics of an idea by maintaining the curve, the line, and not maintaining the exact intervals.
You try to find a way of writing material, let's say melodies or other kinds of material, that has a familiar relationship, but that still has a certain kind of flexible characteristic in the sense that you could modify it. Yeah. In sort of less technical terms, because you described now the sort of technical way that you started composing this or conceiving this. But in less technical terms, what is it that we are listening to? Like in the beginning, you hear this big sort of chunk of material through each other. It becomes also even layers.
Yeah.
And then you get really contrasted material, like very elegant maybe or gracious, beautiful small melody. And then you go back into this kind of... How does that happen compositionally? How do you decide... You know, what kind of material gets to stay? Is that a very intuitive process or?
No. It's not. Of course, intuition is very important, but it is hard work, you know. Because, for example, you could say that it's the form is three part. So in the first part, let's say ABC, you could call it ABA, but. Or ABC is another way, because the last part is the last section is derived from the first one. And what you see in, for example, in the first section A, that you have ostinatos that have certain interval characteristics, and then the intervals are diminishing. They become smaller and smaller and smaller.
Mm.
And when they are really have reached one pitch, then it's not possible to go further than that. The second movement starts. And then...
So the material implodes somehow.
Yeah. And to make a contrast, then at that moment, at the... let's say the border of the two sections, then suddenly the biggest intervals that you can imagine are used to make the same curve, the same line as before, but now in extremely big intervals, so big even that you cannot produce them in the orchestra.
Hmm.
That sounds very strange, but I used octave equivalents, octave parallels, for example, and then you can suggest that it goes even beyond the seven octaves of the piano, you know.
Mm.
Very strange, actually, how a composer can have abstract ideas that has nothing to do with the reality of music.
I mean, one of the very important aspects of your music, of all your pieces, I think, is that rhythm is so vital, is so present. Probably, I mean, it's easy to trace that back maybe to your love of jazz. I mean, I can imagine that this kind of influence has been very important. But also in the way you write for the ensembles or for in the big orchestra piece, rhythm is like super present there. How? Yeah.
I think more than the influence of jazz, maybe it has to do with my years as a child, that there was no instrument. So what I did at school, at home, and everywhere where I was, bumping on tables, on stair chairs, and sometimes people shouting, "Please stop with that noise!" You know? And but because
it was your way of
I don't know
music.
how small I was, how young, I remember that I started to experiment, maybe when I was 5 years old or, well, whatever, two against three.
Oh, yeah.
That's the most simple. But then, if you master that as a child, you can imagine, oh, well, then maybe three against four is also interesting, yeah. But that's more difficult.
I told you not to hit the table because the microphone is on top of it, but doesn't matter.
Yeah, I forgot about
that.
Yeah,
no, yeah, it's fine. interesting. So that's maybe why rhythm, you know, is really like in your body and also in
there was nothing else than rhythm.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's one of the things that for a conductor is always so important to think about this, because you, it's very demanding in flexio what you ask of the orchestra. Yeah, it's very,
absolutely,
you know, it's very crazy. So for us conductors, we always look at like metronome marks and it's like, oh shit, maybe this is too fast, or, you know, how am I gonna make this work? There's always a, this is very much, you know, I'm talking about my job now, not your job, but to try to understand what the core is of what is written down is sometimes not so easy.
But you see, you see that so there is nothing actually 100% fixed in music. It depends on acoustics, for example. And so I can imagine that a conductor, for example, when he is performing this in the Doelen in Rotterdam or in the Concertgebouw Hall here in Amsterdam, that slightly there is a difference in tempo.
I'm curious how it's going to work. But I'm sure we'll find it. And you will be there to tell me whether or not it's okay.
Of course I'll be there.
I'm very happy we're doing this. I'm looking incredibly forward to this concert and to our collaboration. And I want to thank you for a lovely talk.
And I thank you.
Thank you, Theo, for your words and your music. In the last fragment, I wanted to take you back to one of my fondest memories as a violinist of playing his piece Venus and Adonis together with the Insomnia Ensemble. I'll put further information and links to the pieces in the show notes. Thanks for listening to The Treasure Hunt. If there are subjects you would like me to speak about in this podcast, contact me through my website. Please follow this podcast on your favorite platform and stay tuned for the next episode.